Welcome back to Technotopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Mark Hopkins. He is a futurist and writer. This is Technotopia.
Hey, Technotopia listeners, have I got a story for you? Let's go back to 2014. Two researchers are tinkering with a design for a security robot that will patrol your house and guard your stuff when you're not around. But there was a problem. There wasn't all that much the robot could do to stop an intruder. So rather than simply halt development, the two researchers decided to pivot. And by doing so, they realized they had a device that would create a whole new category in robotics. That story is a sneak peek into the robotics episode of a podcast I just started listening to and I love. It's called Trailblazers from Dell Technologies. This podcast is so good. It's hosted by best-selling author Walter Isaacson. And Isaacson has been one of my favorite authors and thinkers, and he's been writing about technology for decades. In his new podcast, he explores stories of disruption, peppered in with insights and lessons from trailblazing guests. To listen to it, I want you to search Trailblazers on your favorite podcast app or stream it on DellTechnologies.com/Trailblazers. That's DellTechnologies.com/Trailblazers.
Welcome back to Technotopia, the podcast about a better future. I'm John Biggs. Today on the show, we have Mark Hopkins. He's a futurist, and you're a VC, and you're doing all kinds of crazy stuff, right, Mark?
Yeah, I just kind of go wherever I get interested in going these days, which is a fun place to be at.
How does that work? Do you just like show up to places? Are you like a Zelig kind of situation where people just give you cool titles?
A little bit, yeah. I was a journalist for a ton of years, and I talked about things that I thought were interesting. And then, you know, a couple of years ago, I mean, most of it was about blockchain. And so a couple of years ago, the rest of the world started thinking blockchain was interesting. And so I just got to get all kinds of crazy invitations to do stuff now.
Mm-hmm. All right, very cool. All right. The past couple of shows have been about blockchain specifically. What's your take on what's happening now and what's going to happen in the next 10 years? I know that's a big question, but
yeah, that's pretty huge. I'm one of those guys that drank the Kool-Aid really early on. I've gone through like all the stages at all these other. Anybody that gets into blockchain and really loves it goes through where it's first, maybe it's about the money or it's about like one specific project. And then, you know, they start getting their eyes open about, hey, maybe this could be a disruptive technology that changes the world. And now I actually was going to take a break for a bit and write a book because I believe so much about like how you could reshape society with blockchain. I was going to like do one of these Ray Kurzweil books where I predict the next 10 years. And every time I'd finish a chapter, I'd look up and it'd be an article that you or somebody else wrote and go, oh, wait, that just happened. So I kind of got back into getting my hands dirty and, you know, getting involved with projects. So now a lot of my writing ends up being in people's white papers and stuff like that as opposed to a book. But I think my imagination, to answer your question, is not big enough to say exactly what it's going to be in 10 years. Because like what I was thinking was 5 years out or 10 years out. Happened like a week later. Mm-hmm. It's just the pace of change in some respects is amazing, and not just in blockchain, but also in cognitive and just-in-time delivery, and I think in general we're headed towards a post-scarcity world. It's just we're not going to know that until we get there, and whether that means it's either going to be Star Trek or Wall-E. You know, that just depends if you're an optimist or a pessimist, I suppose. But mm-hmm. It's going to be like one of those, or maybe somewhere in between.
What does post-scarcity mean in this context? What does it give us if we're post-scarcity?
Well, in this context, it gives. I think. I think about it in terms of meaning more individual liberty or freedom for the individual, like just for people that are, bound to work. Right. A lot of us, when we grew up, if we came from a privileged background, we're told we could be anything, we could do anything, just go to college and, live your dreams. And many of us that weren't as privileged didn't have those opportunities. And I think post-scarcity means in a lot of ways that it elevates the rest of humanity to the level of privilege that, the upper crust of, the first world has and has today.
That's an interesting point. So I was talking with a buddy. He was out with a Boy Scout troop in Michigan, and a lot of Republicans out there hanging out, a lot of Trump supporters. But he said it's less about political beliefs. It's more about a lifestyle. The idea that you want a similar lifestyle that you experienced on the leafy streets of Grand Rapids, riding your bike and doing all this stuff, and you want the same thing for your kids. So you're saying that almost everybody could have that cafes, croissants, good public school down the street, if not a Catholic school kind of situation. Is that the expectation here?
That's the hope, right? I mean, every utopia is somebody else's dystopia, so it's not going to be perfect for everybody. I think that eventually we'll get there because I am an optimist, and you know, intelligent people disagree with me, but that's where my brain's at.
Mm-hmm. What does it take not to fall into despair in situations like this? How do you maintain optimism when we see weird stuff happening?
And this actually kind of goes to me contradicting 10 years ago me. The number one thing I've done for my mental health is I logged off of Facebook and I mitigate the amount of time I do on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And that was really difficult to do as someone who's a former journalist who likes to drink from the fire hose. But what monolithic centralized data consumption platforms have turned into is not healthy for the human brain. I've come to realize, I'm only like 2-3 months into this experiment, and it's transformed my mental health. I'm able to be far more productive. I don't get depressed. I don't get sucked into these. You know, a buddy of mine I've worked with for years says that Twitter is a great platform for making you like people you haven't met yet, and Facebook is a great platform for making you hate people you already know. I got tired of hating my friends for like really stupid, but you know, not very nice political beliefs. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, I'll break bread with a lot of these people and we'll have a great discussion and I'll never touch on politics and we agree on 90% of life. But then there's that one political belief that's, you know, they're a MAGA guy or, you know, they believe something strange about, you know, ultra progressive that's outside of the step of the norm, and you get caught up in these dumb arguments about them. Or, you know, they hate the fact that you're a crypto blockchain person. So like, how can you believe in something that's going to destroy whatever, these weird arguments, they happen all the time and they're not necessary. Because ultimately nobody's brain is going to get flipped to a new position from those arguments. So why are we having them? Why are we forcing ourselves to have these conversations? It's important to be up to date on the news, and I've gone back to basically my old ways of consuming data. I use Feedly and have OPML files.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to force myself into more decentralization on a personal level when it comes to news consumption.
Interesting. So you've actually gone back to what everybody used to do. Everybody used to have your feed. You used to have your feed, your feed reader, and you just go through. Like, I mean, I have my tabs that I open every morning. I got about 20 of them, and I get most of the stuff that I need to know out of those tabs. What happened over the past couple years that forced us to go to Facebook for that information? Is it just because it's easier, or is it just because it's there?
I mean, I think this is, and I'm hoping I'm just not echoing 10-year-old Mark or 10 years ago Mark, because I thought that social was going to be this great. I mean, I ran with like the Dave Weiner, you know, Adam Curry, John Furrier crowd, where I thought like, hey, you know, this is going to be the thing that changes the world and makes media more democratized, and to an extent and for a little bit it did. But the internet wasn't decentralized enough and there was no incentives for things to stay decentralized. The incentive was just like it has been throughout all of humanity for kind of power to coalesce. And so that's what it did, you know? And Twitter is a monolithic platform and Facebook is a monolithic platform. And because we were in this era of thinking like egalitarian, mm-hmm. and like, okay, the news must be free to disrupt the, you know, the big stodgy New York Times, Washington Post, LA Times people, then, you know, the only way to monetize it was by selling the audience in a way that what didn't really have their best interest in heart.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, a lot of people even initially pushed back. I mean, you and I covered a lot of the same trends, about, and, you know, like the Matt Ingram stories, you know, where he would talk about like, oh, micropayments could take over. And there was a ton of really great experiments during the Web 2.0 era about mm-hmm. micropayments. But I mean, it all came down to an antiquated financial system that couldn't handle payments of, you know, 50 cents or less without costing another 50 cents to handle it, right? PayPal's really still not great at handling super small transactions. It's really great at like $1.50 to, you know, mm-hmm. maybe $1,000, but anything below $1.50 is not a super great platform for that until blockchain came along. And you can handle, you know, fractions of a penny on certain blockchains and do all kinds of micropayments instantly. We had an early experiment in one of my companies that was, we were creating a content production company,
mm-hmm.
and we could actually meter the you know, writers. We've always metered in newsrooms that I've run. Writers get paid by the word.
Okay.
And you get a word cap, and it incentivizes them to be pithy and that sort of thing. And whenever we launched this this mode of writing as a content firm, we allowed people to get paid in Bitcoin and payable by the word. So the minute that an editor approved their words, they could have an instant transaction of, you know, $17 or $125 and change or whatever. But that's that same thing is available, you know, on the other side of the equation. Once we get there, you see it with Steemit, you see it with library projects like that, where content creators can get paid the moment something is consumed with, you know, a fraction of a penny taken out, as opposed to some giant percentage or a base fee of, you know, a dollar or two.
So this is actually fascinating stuff, and this is stuff I'm really excited about. But it just hasn't taken hold. What's stopping it from taking hold? Why can't I pay per click on New York Times website? Why do you think that is?
Well, we're still in the science experiment phase of this, and this all comes in waves. I think we're probably hitting the end of the third wave of blockchain science experiments, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at, like, you know, Bitcoin being the first wave, and along with Bitcoin was kind of like Namecoin and Devcoin that established some of the models, but it was still very 1.0. And then, like, the second wave would have been kind of Ethereum,
mm-hmm.
And other Turing complete blockchains. And now we're in a third wave of stuff being built on top of that and stuff that are competing with those second wave projects. I think we probably have, unless the cycles start compressing, which is certainly possible, you know, given the iterative nature of technology and Moore's law and things like that, we probably are another like 4 years, 3 or 4 years away from mainstream adoption of these types of technologies from mainstream companies, because, you know, it's the innovator's dilemma. They got a lot to lose. It's the same reason why the New York Times didn't switch to e-delivery until way, way, way late. Like, if you Sean Piani and I did a story at Mashable right whenever. Remember Esquire came out with that e-ink cover? And it was, yeah. So we did like a breakdown of that thing and talked about like what was going on with the innards. And then we did a couple of video podcasts back then talking about the revenue models and the business models. And we did the numbers based upon what e-ink was selling for at the time. And if the New York Times had bought every one of their subscribers a top of the line like Kindle at the time, it was like $300, and just delivered the New York Times on that instead of delivering a daily paper, they would have saved like 40% over existing delivery model. But it was just too experimental at the time. Like there were so many clear advantages that we now know would probably have saved a lot of what they're trying to do in the past. It's that innovator's dilemma. We know delivering a piece of paper is going to work at least, you know, for the next, you know, 10 years or 5 years. So we're not going to screw that up just for this thing that may disrupt ourselves and may change everything and make it better, or it could make it 10 times worse. And if you look at what Steemit is, like Steemit is probably like the top of the line, like micropayments publishing platform, has some real issues. I mean, look at the quality of it. It's not Medium. It's enabling a lot of cool things, but people aren't making a living on it unless they're doing kind of exorbitant ICO pump and dump type blog posts, which is not ideal. There's still a lot of tweaking to happen there.
So what's going to happen? Is it the institutional folks? Is it New York Times, Wall Street Journal who bear the fruits of all this technology? Or is it blogs and up and coming media organizations? What happens to these old industrial style media farms?
That's a really good question. And it's one I think about a lot, and I don't know that I have the answer right now, because it's one of those things where like the domino could tip in one about five or six different ways. Mm-hmm. I think that what's more likely is you're going to see like a middle of the pack entertainment based news organization, like something that, you know, they kind of made their, like BuzzFeed did, you know, they kind of, you know, threw away all the entrenched ideas when they kind of, I mean, they built a little bit on the old and a little bit on the new, but they said, okay, we're going to monetize a completely different way. And we're going to do one type of content for, you know, the first few years. And it worked really well for them. It's probably going to be an organization like that, that shows that it can be done and still create quality journalism. And then, you know, just like what happened with BuzzFeed, just like what happened at TechCrunch, you know, Mike showed the world that it could be done. Ohm showed the world that it could be done, and you could create quality content. And then, okay, then everybody's, it's like, starts marching in that direction. And it'll probably be like the New York Times, LA Times, Washington Post that is last to that party, but they'll eventually come.
Were we right in our goal to destroy old media? And I say this as you and I, as early bloggers, as me running Gizmodo early on and basically just hosing PC Magazine and a lot of other titles. Computer Shopper was one of my favorite magazines back in the 90s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then we basically turned it into a pamphlet. Were we right in doing that?
You know, I ask myself that all the time. Because, I mean, if you shorten the narrative too much, you get, the New York Times messed up on a bunch of stories, then a bunch of neckbeards got on their computers and started blogging, and now we've got President Trump, right? Mm-hmm. Which, if you too short, makes us sound like monsters. But I do believe that, number one, it was probably inevitable, because you just can't have the internet as a distribution tool and not have media end up going there. So if it wasn't us, it was going to be somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think if I could go back in a time machine and kill Hitler on this one, I would probably say to all of us as we were doing that is, let's pay closer attention to what people like Dave Weiner is saying.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Decentralization matters. And he has never come off message on that. Decentralization matters. RSS is a great fundamental technology. We should have pushed back more against like the Facebooks mm-hmm. and the Googles when they said, like, you know, it's not that important. You know, we can just build an API. It's basically the same thing. No, mm-hmm. it's not. It's really not.
So we should have. So it seems what you're saying is we were open source zealots, and I think this is true. I've written about this before. We were all our generation, I guess you could say, the tail end of Gen X was all about user generated content. We were making zines, we had BBSs, making mixtapes, all the remix kind of stuff. It's all about user generated content, and we saw that as the gold standard for media. That's what I would argue with the Gawker blogs and all the other stuff. What Jason Calacanis did is he dumped out 50 blogs that we're making, that we're talking about loss, that we're talking about all the kind of these other topics. And he basically drowned out all of the conversation, especially on the formal media. So we created this user generated content, and then ultimately somebody came along and put our zines in like a glossy magazine and tried to sell it. And that's exactly what Facebook is now, which is kind of frustrating. Cause I mean, if we're true to ourselves on that front, and I don't think we have to be, if we're true to ourselves on that front, then we've essentially given up the keys to our user generated kingdom. And we've actually ruined a lot of stuff, by doing that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, but look at the revenue model that you've created with some of your media efforts these days. I mean, that's really what the ideal scenario is, for, you know, that future, you know, the one that didn't get disrupted by Twitter and Facebook and the mm-hmm. social networks, is where, you know, some of your content is free. You know, if it ages a little bit, it becomes free. And if you want it fast, you have to pay for it, and you're multi-platform. I mean, this was kind of what John Furrier and I did, and Dave Vellante at SiliconANGLE, mm-hmm. is we took a pledge very early on, because for some stupid reason, John and I thought, okay, let's launch a blog in 2009, you know, and that's going to be a working, but we took a minute, you know, as soon as we started signing up for the display ad networks, we're like, oh wait, we can't pay our rent with these unless we have 10 million viewers. So we said, it was an easy pledge to make. We're never going to run a display ad on the site. Mm-hmm. We're just going to use every other monetization model. And that really works. Like, it's, I mean, don't get me wrong, I went without a few meals for a couple of years in the first couple of years of SiliconANGLE. Mm-hmm. It was scrimping and saving. But, I mean, they were like a $6 to $10 million a year company when I left them.
Nice.
So, and, you know, it's, you can do that with underwriting. And that's industry news, but you could also do that with straight journalism. You could do that with like civic journalism, because everyone has a vested interest in topics being covered. I mean, PBS has been around, you know, for years and years, and for the last like 20 has subsisted mostly off of underwriting from the private sector, not the public sector. So it's a model that works. It's just that, you know, it's not conventional wisdom, so a lot of people don't go for it.
All right, so there is a future, and it's not a horrible one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's good. That's good to know. All right, Mark, this is fascinating, because I feel like I can talk to you about some of the horrible experiences that I had over the past. Gosh, it's been like 20 years now that I've been blogging, which is nuts.
Yeah. It's like we went through the same war together, huh?
Yeah, exactly. I asked Joel Johnson once, the guy who hired me over at Gizmodo, and I was like, did you go into therapy because of the blogging? He was like, yeah, absolutely. It's just it was tough on the brain, but at least I can write 28 posts a day if I need to. That's a good skill.
100%.
No, I
legitimately went through therapy because of blogging. It took a toll on my marriage, and we literally had to go to marriage therapy.
Wow.
For a minute, because I was spending too much time doing stuff rather than paying attention to life.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, there you have it. That's the answer to sadness is to stop using the computer so much.
Yeah.
Mark, thank you for joining us in Technotopia. This has been a really cool conversation.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Thanks.
Technotopia is brought to you by Happy Fun Corp. Happy Fun Corp is a design-driven technology company in Brooklyn, New York that specializes in building mobile and web applications for startups and Fortune 500 companies. Whether it's a new mobile or web application that will help people experience the internet in a fun new way, or software that will interface with a new piece of top-secret hardware, Happy Fun Corp is always up to the challenge. Big or small, Happy Fun Corp loves building software and loves working with great people. Come build with them. HappyFunCorp.com.
Technotopia is presented by your host, John Biggs. It was produced by Rick Barr of Bar 26 Entertainment at ricksvoice.com. It appears every Friday at noon, and we're always looking to talk to interesting people. Tweet @JohnBiggs if you'd like to join us on the show.